Frank Muir goes into the Navy and investigates the humor of the subject with the help of Alfred Marks.
There was a galley in the Roman Navy full of galley slaves, and one day one of the slaves died at his bench, and immediately all the guards got out their whips and started lashing the rest of the slaves. One of them said, "Hey, what's that? That's a bit much. What have you done? What's all this about then?" The chief guard said, "Oh, don't you know? When someone goes, we always have a whip round." A young British naval lieutenant had to go on a special assignment to Gibraltar, and there wasn't a Navy ship to bring him back, so the Admiralty reserved a berth for him on a passenger liner. And when he got to report to the docks at Gibraltar, a young lady met him in terrible distress. She said, "Excuse me, you're the last hope I have. My father is dangerously ill. I must get back to England. Yours is the last berth on the ship. May I have it, please?" Being a gentleman and officer, he said, "Of course, madam, you may." And he gave the girl his berth, and he wired to Chatham, "Sir, have given berth to girl, returning on next available ship." Signal came back from his commanding officer, "Congratulations on your most remarkable achievement. Your next confinement will be in barracks."
Ordinary Seaman Marks, you've been found guilty of indiscipline. You are sentenced to 7 days on bread and water. How do you like that?
Toasted, if you don't mind. Policeman on his beat in Portsmouth found a sailor lying on the floor with blood all over his face. He picked the young man up and said, "Could you describe the man who hit you?" He said, "That's what I was doing when he hit me." I say, Frank.
Yes?
Do you know how you sink an Irish submarine?
No, Alfred. Tell me, how do you sink an Irish submarine?
You put it in water. The resident bore was pontificating in the naval club. "Yes, the worst thing that happened to me was during the war in the Pacific. My troopship was torpedoed. I had to live for a fortnight on a tin of beans." "Good heavens," said one of his friends. "How on earth did you manage to stay on?" There was another girl, and this one wanted to go to America, you see, and she couldn't afford the fare, so she went down to the docks and met the captain of a ship, and she told him a problem. She was a very pretty girl. It didn't take the captain very long to come up with a solution. "Look," he said, "all you have to do is to stay in my cabin through the whole trip. When we get to America, I'll let you know." Well, the girl was game. She stayed in his cabin. Didn't see anyone for a fortnight, except the captain, of course. After a fortnight, the steward came into the cabin and asked what she was doing there. The girl burst into tears, told him all about how she wanted to get to America. This was the only way she could do it. He said, "Well, miss, you'll be hell of a time getting there. This is the Isle of Wight ferry."
The lure of the sea is strong, or so we're constantly told. Certainly for years, a large number of British men have gone down to the sea in ships. It's supposed to be because we're an island people, living on a precious stone set in a silver sea. Certainly from earliest times, it was clear to anyone who wanted to get out of England that he'd have to cross the water, and that for the defence of our island, we would need a navy. Now, attitudes to the sea have always varied. Hilaire Belloc was ambivalent on the subject.
"To sail the sea is an occupation at once repulsive and attractive."
Joseph Conrad was more mystical about it.
"The sea never changes, and its works, for all the talk of men, are wrapped in mystery."
But to the real enthusiast, the type who's said to have salt water in his veins, the sea is the first priority of life, overriding everything else. Brooks Atkinson.
"Land was created to provide a place for steamers to visit."
The fascination for the sea, of necessity, involves at least an interest in boats. Again, for the fanatics, this interest becomes total dedication. Kenneth Graham's Ratty.
"Believe me, my young friend, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats."
When I had a canal boat, it was more like boating about in mess. In the Navy, messing about in boats becomes a bit more serious, though not much more. However, one should remember that the primary function of the Navy is military, and many naval reminiscences are of action in time of war. Let's hear Bill Cosby's experiences.
I joined the Navy, and I became a medic, hospital corpsman. I was very proud. Instant doctorship. That's what it is. In 6 weeks, you can operate on people, give them needles, kill them, you know, that kind of thing. You know, you pronounce people dead, you know, you're dead. Thanks a lot. Get out of the service. And I never forget. When I graduated from hospital corps school, an order came through sending me to the Fleet Marine Force. This means I am going to be a medic. I was very proud of it because I know that I read the Geneva Convention, and it's a small print and everything. It says, in the Geneva Convention, you cannot shoot a medic. And they're very happy about the whole thing. You know, they give you anatomy in one day. You know, here's the body. Look at it. Remember it. All right, next shot. You know, that kind of thing. And so they give you a helmet with a big red cross on it. See? And then they give you a jersey with a big red cross on it. This is so when the enemy sees the red cross, see, they don't shoot at you. See, they just said, red, there's a guy with a red cross, don't hit him. You know, in times of war, they do that. See, don't throw that hand grenade over there. There's a guy with a red cross. What's wrong with you? You know, that kind of thing. See, well, they do that, see, don't they? Oh, they're nice about it. So we're really proud of that. We can't get shot down. You know, that's wonderful. So then they show us the real movie as we're about to go to war, just before we land. I said, I want to show you this picture here. You'll notice that the corpsmen are dropping like flies. That's because the enemy is not upholding the Geneva Convention, you know, and they said the first thing they try and get actually is a hospital corpsman, and actually the lifespan of a hospital corpsman from the time his foot hits the water to the time he almost gets to the beach is 7 seconds. And, you know, the corpsmen are scrambling after that. Give me some steel wool. Get this red cross off of here. You know, anybody want to buy a helmet with a red cross on it, you know, for a gun? How about some morphine? Take this helmet with some morphine, you know. So I was aware of this, you know, I was really frightened. And I said, gee whiz, I said, I hope they don't get me, you know. And I run, they let down the thing, you know, bang. First thing I did, man, was scurry to the beach, you know. Jump in a foxhole, safe. I'm not moving. I'm sorry, I'm not moving. There's five guys with me, and we're having fun. We're watching the war, you know. There's war going on, yeah. Somebody's winning a firework. Ooh, look, a ship in the air, you know. That kind of thing. And there, an explosion went off about 100 feet away. And a piece of shrapnel caught one of the guys, you know, and zonked him right out. He's gone, you know. And there's a guy next to, zonk means dead. And there's a guy next to me, typical movie nut. You know, I didn't even know they were real. I thought they were just in the movie, you know. Why? They got Charlie. Shut up. Be quiet, man. Watch the war. Watch the war. You know. No, they got Charlie, and I'm going to get him. You're not going to do nothing. Get out of the foxhole and shut up. I'm going to get him. Will you get... And he broke loose, and he runs nowhere but right out into the open, man. He's scurrying around. Where are you, rotten? You know, whatever. And these guys, there, the enemy's hiding up in the trees having fun. You know, ka-doo, 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 ka-doo. Anybody want this nut scurrying around out here in the open there, you know? And the first thing they do is, bah, 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 and they gun him down. First thing this guy says is, medic! I said, what do you want? My leg, my leg. I don't make house calls. Take two aspirin and mail in the $5. No, it's a true story.
Bill Cosby. As in the army, naval decisions in time of war are made at the top by admirals and such like. The men who are put in charge of the navy aren't always the most obvious choice. Here's the view of Sir Edward Carson, who got his job in the 1916 coalition.
My only qualification of being put in charge of the navy is that I'm very much at sea.
Engaging British honesty. Let's have another example of that engaging British honesty quality. A remark attributed to Vice Admiral Beatty at the Battle of Jutland as he watched the sinking of his country's battle cruisers.
There seems to be something wrong with our bloody ships today.
But the British sailor keeps his cool in moments of victory as well as defeat. Here's a report from Reynolds News.
It was quite a thrilling moment when the U-boat sank, he said. But such is the sang-froid of the modern British seaman, there was no burst of cheering, only a little polite hand-clapping from the gun crews.
The one thing sailors can't do in a disaster is to comfort themselves that worse things happen at sea. The dangers of naval encounters are enormous. A report from a daily paper.
All the six main workships were destroyed, five of them severely.
But even without the devastations of warfare, the sea has other hazards to put off all but the most intrepid. Dr. Johnson was not one of the most intrepid.
No man will be a sailor with contrivance enough to get himself into jail. For being in a ship is being in a jail with a chance of being drowned. A man in jail has more room, more food, and commonly better company.
Douglas Jerrold was also wary.
Love the sea? I dote upon it, from the beach.
And many of us who like the idea of boats and things get less enthusiastic when the sea goes choppy. Here's some unhelpful comfort from Jerome K. Jerome.
It's a curious fact, but nobody is ever seasick on land.
But in a rough sea, it doesn't take long for fair-weather sailors to start praying. Samuel Butler.
How holy people look when they're seasick.
Yes, seasickness is a major hazard of seagoing.
Cast off. Knit two together.
On the road that runs to the harbor wall, where the loving landsmen sleep, I hear a strange, mysterious call. 'Tis the call of the ocean. Sea, to see a rollicking boat where the breakers roar and the salt spray flies, and a singling man can stretch his eyes.
Why, here's a boat.
Come, let us set it afloat. Hey ho for the open sea, with a scudding sail and the sharp wind's kiss. And I say to myself, say I, why this is the life for me. A tiller that kicks like a living thing,
while the main brace sings on high.
Sing on, O main brace.
I think whatever the sea may bring.
Ready am I.
Oh, to be riding high in the teeth of a thundering gale, with the decks awash and the bowsprits crack, as I bring her about on the starboard tack. Why, here's a gale.
Michael Flanders and Donald Swan doing some tremendous playing underneath his singing. And yet, in spite of its hazards, the sea still has magnetic powers of attraction. There are some people who just have to be sailors. A description of one such by Spike Milligan.
He told me he had the sea in his blood. And believe me, you can see when it gets in.
That bit wasn't written. Sailors, of course, have strange habits, as the Reverend Richard Harris Barham recognised in his poem Misadventures at Margate.
It's very odd that sailor men should talk so very queer.
and a report from the Kensington... I repeat, a report from the Kensington News.
When asked by counsel how he knew that they were transvestites, he said he'd spent 2.5 years in the Merchant Navy and he could recognize them.
Another thing that seafaring men are noted for is their love of drink. Let's hear a report from the News Chronicle.
The accused of no fixed abode, said to have an incurable urge for drinking the liquor out of ship's compasses, was sentenced yesterday at Aberdeen to 4 months' imprisonment for stealing a gallon of mixture from the compass of a trawler berthed at Aberdeen.
They took him down to the cells and he pointed north. But in spite of their little quirks, sailors have to be very heroic. Danger is never far away when you're on the sea, and everyone who sails there must be alert at all times, from a Scottish newspaper.
Mr. Cumble, who was on the boat deck, jumped to the rails and threw a lifeboat to the drowning man.
Drowning is the sailor's nightmare, and quite a few other people's nightmares too. A little Shakespearean verse from June Mercer Langfield.
Full fathom five thy father lies, his aqualung was the wrong size.
Let us never forget the names of our great seafarers. Drake, Frobisher, Hawkins, Nelson. Actually, do you remember that lovely Radio Times billing there was for Nelson?
Radio 4, 7:30, The Life of Horatio Nelson. For details, see top of column.
In similar vein, let's hear of a book catalogue of a saga of naval heroism.
The Teeth of the Storm, second impression, two large plates.
Tales of heroism on the high seas have provided the movie makers of the world with magnificent stories for films.
We're going to show you an old film. Now, this was made in CinemaScope, and unfortunately, therefore, will not fit exactly onto your radio sets. Now, this may result in the beginnings and ends of sentences being slightly chopped off. We would like to apologize for this.
Entieth century foe, resent. A inimus cop. Phil! Tiny on the Bount. Starring Charles Love and Clark Gubb.
Ice the men, bra.
Arden, Captain Blig.
Ice the men, bra.
Ardo.
Esther Christia.
Yes, Cat.
This man is deaf as a pope. Oh, then, Elmet. And of all my ship's officers gone.
They're all in bed with Kirby, Cap.
Kirby?
No, Kirby, that new kitchen maid, Cap.
Esther, gentlewoman, who will all pay for this, all of you? I'll have you all flogged to death for this.
That's what you think.
What do you mean?
Eve decided it's Tim to get rid of you. He's going to dump you in the Porsche of the screen that's been cut off, Blig.
Oh, wouldn't dare. Oh, wouldn't dare do that to your cat. Oh, let go of my arm. Let go of me. Let go of me.
Lovely piece had Joe Kendall, Nigel Rees, Chris Emmett and Fred Harris and was from The Birkis Way. Nowadays, recruitment into the Navy is voluntary, but there was a time when the job was done by force. Those were the days of the press gang. To stretch your heartstrings, perhaps even cause them to throb, Mr. Alfred Marx will now recite a sad poem about the press gang. Thomas Hood's pathetic ballad, Faithless Sally Brown.
Young Benny was a nice young man, a carpenter by trade, and he fell in love with Sally Brown, that was a lady's maid. But as they fetched a walk one day, they met a press gang crew, and Sally, she did faint away, whilst Benny was brought to. The boatswain swore with wicked words enough to shock a saint, that though she did seem in a fit, 'Twas nothing but a feint. Come, girl, said he, hold up your head. He'll be as good as me. For when your swain is in our boat, a boatswain he will be. And he is gone, and he is gone, she cried and wept outright. Then I will to the waterside and see him out of sight. A waterman came up to her. Now, young woman, said he, if you weep on so, you will make eye water in the sea. Alas, they've taken my bow, Ben, to sail with old Ben Bow. And her woe began to run afresh, as if she'd said, gee, woe. Said he, they've only taken him to the tender ship, you see. The tender ship, cried Sally Brown. What a hardship that must be. Now, Ben had sailed to many a place that's underneath the world, but in 2 years the ship came home and all the sails were furled. But when he called on Sally Brown to see how she went on, he found she'd got another Ben, whose Christian name was John. Oh, Sally Brown, how could you serve me so? I've met with many a breeze before, but never such a blow. And then he tried to sing All's Well, but could not, though he tried. His head was turned, and so he chewed his pigtail till he died. His death, which happened in his birth, at 40-odd befell. They went and told the sexton, and the sexton told the bell.
Thank you, Alfred. Try and get a little rest now. Like all branches of the forces, the Navy is a tangled web of regulations, or at least so it seems to the outsider. However, attempts are being made to clarify the role and activities of the senior service. From the Seven Oaks News.
Royal Navy at home. Members of the public will be afforded the opportunity to tell a captain what to do with his ship.
In common with the other forces, the Navy is very insistent on rank and the respect due to rank. This can be very clearly demonstrated by the following extract from an Admiralty Stores list.
Potts Chamber Plain. Potts Chamber with Admiralty monogram in blue for hospital use. Potts Chamber fluted with royal cipher in gold for flag officers only. Potts Chamber round rubber lunatic.
And that's the whole boat's crew, really, isn't it? The strength and glory of the Navy is, of course, her ships. And it is small wonder that a great ceremony is made of the launching of each new vessel from a provincial paper.
The vessel left the Ways at noon and safely took the water before her scheduled time. Before leaving the Ways, Lady White was able to perform the launching ceremony. There was no danger that she would collapse sideways.
Ships are constantly being improved to attain new feats of efficiency and speed. A report from the Johannesburg Star.
During the war, on several occasions, the Queen Elizabeth attained a speed of 31 knots, and he thought she could possibly exceed this speed if pushed.
In times of peace, the Navy's job is largely a policing one, seeing that other sea users obey international laws and keep out of trouble. This work is carried on with a customary, unfailing British courtesy. A report from the Daily Express.
Spokesman for the Ministry said last night, patrol launches have orders not to order trawlers away from the area. They merely inform the skippers that they're in an area where bombing is about to commence. They usually cooperate by moving.
And in peacetime, navies also spend a lot of time in elaborate manoeuvres and tests, like seeing how long a nuclear submarine can stay underwater. Here's the captain of the USS Codfish addressing his crew after 2 years without surfacing.
Men, I know you're all anxious to be reunited with your loved ones, in some cases your wives. But we have a few moments before we surface, and I've just jotted down some things that I think are kind of important. I wouldn't take the time if I didn't. First of all, I think we ought to give the cooks a standing ovation for the wonderful job they've done. So if you men want to stand now, and let's really hear it for the cooks. I don't think you men realize the difficult problem it is aboard a submarine to... You men want to stand now for the cooks? Come on now, men, let's let bygones be bygones and hear it for the cooks, huh? Look, men, I'm not going to surface until I hear it for the cooks. All right, that's a little better. Today, as we add another glorious page to the history of the USS Codfish, I think it's important that we reflect on some of the past glories of the Codfish. I don't know how many of you men know this, but the Codfish holds a record for the most Japanese tonnage sunk, being comprised of five freighters and 15 aircraft carriers. A truly enviable record. Unfortunately, they were sunk in 1954. However, it stands as the largest peacetime tonnage ever. Our voyage has received a lot of coverage in the newspaper, and I'd like to present our side of it. I think our firing on Miami Beach can best be termed ill-timed. It happened on what they call in the newspaper business a slow news day, and as a result received a lot more space than I think it deserved, since it was the off-season down there. Man, I think you'll agree I've been pretty lax as far as discipline is concerned, and golly, nobody enjoys a joke more than I do. But I would like the executive officer returned. Now, we've looked in the torpedo tubes, we've looked in your bags, and I mean, it's been over 2 weeks, man, and we're just damn lucky that it wasn't the navigational officer or someone real important like that. Looking back on the mutiny, I think a lot of the trouble stemmed from the fact that you men weren't coming to me with your problems. As I told you, the door to my office is always open. I think you know why it's always open. That was stolen. I'd like that returned. It looks like the work of the same man. But since we started the cruise on such a low note, I think it's important that we try to end it on a high note. And to me, there is nothing more impressive in the Navy as a submarine breaks water to see a bunch of sailors in their dress blues as they come rushing up out of the... that hole there. And come to a parade rest. This to me is one of the... all right. Man, I've just been notified that we'll be surfacing in just a moment. And you might be happy to know that you'll be gazing on the familiar skyline of either New York City or Buenos Aires. Is that? I can't. All right, dismiss, man. That's all.
It's Bob Newhart. And that's about it for the Navy. Let's close with an epitaph on a sailor.
Here lies a tar who all his life did play the tartar to his wife, but he was drowned off Zanzibar, so now it's tar-tar-tar, tartar.
That's the end of our program, and of our series, and possibly of our careers. Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye, Alfred.
Goodbye, sailor.
Frank Muir Goes Into the Navy was produced by Simon Brett.